books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, visually impaired author Beth O'Brien tells us about reimagining Little Red Riding Hood as Wolf Siren. Plus, we've got Nicholas Jubber on The Fairy Tellers and some new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Wolf Siren by Beth O'Brien has been described as a vibrant, evocative and magical debut, which centres a positive, empowered, disabled character at the heart of a reimagining of Little Red Riding Hood. Author Beth O'Brien has a visual impairment, which we'll find out about in a moment, as does the narrator of Wolf Siren, Niamh Longford.
I found my grandmother in the woods quite by accident, so I suppose it made sense that I'd lose her there too. I was 9, and I'd slipped away from my village because the smell of warm rain hung around longer in the trees. But, as my mother always told me, I shouldn't have been there at all. I was focused on the ground, watching it beneath my feet carefully. The earth was stodgy, and it gave way slightly with every step I took. I knew that if I was to trip and fall, I'd be covered in mud, and Mother would be furious. So, I only looked up when a gnarled branch reached down and tapped my shoulder. "What is it?" The sunlight bounced off the glossy wet leaves like sparkles in a brook, and I squinted through the glistening haze. I have never been able to see well. I don't know how the trees know this, but they often draw my attention to things I might otherwise miss. The branch tapped my shoulder again. A wizened twig stretched out like a finger, and I stared around through the shifting light. The woods seemed more alive after the rain, as though the very air was releasing a sigh of pleasure. But there was something else there too, a feeling that was much harder to identify. The tree curled her twig branches over my shoulder, as though she was preparing to steady me, and I covered the rough twigs with my hand to reassure her. I turned slowly, looking from tree to tree, scanning the ground, peering up into the lower branches for whatever the woods thought deserved my focus.
First of all, Beth, could you tell us about your sight condition?
Yeah, of course. So I was born with a severe visual impairment, and I have a long list of conditions that, quite honestly, I never remember all of the names. But essentially, I see light and some colour in my right eye, but not much vision at all. And then in my left eye, I have slightly more vision, but a very narrow field of vision, not very good distance vision. So, yeah, I describe my vision as I see mostly out of like the lower right-hand corner of my left eye, and the rest of it is just sort of a nice blur of whatever I guess it might be.
Are you a cane user or a guide dog user?
No. So at school I had mobility training, but for a simple cane, not for a long cane. But actually when I was 17 or 18, my vision deteriorated. And that was a big thing, because it was a strange one, because I was already visually impaired, but then my vision got worse and I sort of stayed in that same category of visual impairment, but the way I experienced the world really shifted. So that had a big impact on, I guess, my confidence and how I had to navigate things. But my mum will hate hearing this, but yeah, mostly I just bundle along and hope for the best.
Now, we heard at the start a clip of Niamh Longford reading from Wolf Siren. Tell us about the book.
So Wolf Siren is the first novel I've ever written, and it all sort of began because I found myself wondering why Little Red Riding Hood doesn't actually recognise that her grandmother's been replaced by a wolf when she goes to visit her in her cottage. And I was studying creative writing at the time, and we were doing a lot of work on fairy tale retellings, and I was specifically interested in disability representation. And all of these thoughts sort of came together for me to think, oh my gosh, that would be such an interesting way of interpreting Red Riding Hood as potentially a partially sighted person. And as someone who is a avid reader slash audiobooker, then I began to think that I actually don't know many books that show visual impairment as a sort of partial way of seeing. Often in literature, blindness is total. Their characters have no vision whatsoever, which isn't my experience, and I know it isn't the experience of the majority of people who are visually impaired. So it began from there. It's a loose Red Riding Hood retelling, so it features many familiar elements from the traditional story, such as the red coat, there are wolves, there's a grandmother in the woods. But I very much set it up as like the woods are a forbidden place where Red, my main character, isn't meant to go, but she is far too rebellious to abide by that rule and frequently sneaks off there. There's lots of magic and mystery and secrets that slowly unravel and cause her a lot of trouble. But yeah, that's more or less where it sort of came from and why I wrote it.
I saw blurs of greens and browns, greys and blacks, but nothing that stood out. So instead, I tried the trick I'd been using for as long as I could remember, and I stayed still. I waited. The movement that caught my attention was steady and assured. Not the panicked flight of a bird or some small mammal diving into the undergrowth. I watched the grey shape, and for the briefest moment, I was sure it was a wolf. My heart leapt with a thrill that could have been either joy or fear. I remained quite still and told myself to be rational. For one thing, the wolves only ever attacked the men. For another, there hadn't been an attack since I was 4 years old. But I always tried to avoid thinking about that day. It was the first time I saw my mother cry, and the last time I saw my father alive. Father was one of many men to be taken by the wolves. Where once our village had been famous for its lucrative wolf fur trade, courtesy of our skilled hunters, soon it was associated with nothing but violent attacks. No matter how many men the mayor conscripted to try and keep the wolves at bay, our losses continued to mount up. Shortly after my father's death, the mayor was forced to admit defeat, disband the hunters entirely, and forbid all men and boys from entering the woods.
She's certainly more feisty and feminist than the original Red Riding Hood.
Yeah, but even in the original, one of the things I thought about was how Red Riding Hood's mother is very insistent she takes one path through the woods. But actually then Red Riding Hood doesn't do that. She strays from it and talks to the wolf. And in some versions, she is very much punished for that, aka gobbled up. But in others, she is a bit more rebellious. And I really love what there's one Italian version where she gets to her grandmother's house and Red Riding Hood realizes something's up and pretends to need the toilet in order to escape. And the wolf doesn't want to let her go. But eventually he agrees because she says, I have to go big, not little. And then he lets her go. She goes outside to the privy and then just runs till she gets home safe and sound. So actually there are some early versions of the story where she does use her own initiative to escape some pretty risky situations. But yeah, I think I ramped up the maybe environmental aspect and the feminist aspect and the disability aspect of the traditional scale, maybe up to 100, and then wrote my book.
I've done a few shows recently. There wasn't any planning on this, but I had two shows in a row that were about hidden disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrative version of a hidden disability is either the person is cured or they don't survive the story. Do you find that's the same with disability in literature?
Yes, and I'd say even especially in fairy tales and even fairy tale retellings. And that was really something I was conscious of when coming up with the idea for Wolf Siren, but also why I wanted to retell Red Riding Hood, because actually, if we're considering Red Riding Hood from the traditional story as partially cited as a reason she doesn't recognise that her grandmother's been replaced by a wolf, she isn't cured by the end. Sometimes she's saved by a passing huntsman, sometimes she saves herself, sometimes she, you know, is eaten, so that's not great. But yeah, being cured is very much a fairy tale trope, specifically if you're a good character. But if you're not a morally good character, then you are not cured, and it's seen as some sort of punishment, like a deserved negative trait. So those are all things I was aware of before I even started writing and definitely didn't want to replicate. And also there are other characters with disabilities within this story as well. So it wasn't through Red's story, but just through the other characters as well. I hope to present a bit more of a nuanced, realistic and authentic depiction of disability within the same magical, fantastical world that fairy tales we find ourselves drawn to. but without relying on those, as I see them, negative tropes.
And your advocacy for representation goes as far as you founding Disabled Tales. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was a proper passion project of mine where I just was sat alone in my room and just thought it would be really cool if there was a place where disabled writers, poets, artists, and even essayists could have a dedicated place where we discuss the representation of disability in folklore and fairy tales, because I know I'm not alone in feeling that, well, when I was growing up, those stories were sort of where I saw disability representation. And it's got a lot better, especially in children's fiction. But a lot of the time, these sort of early exposure to these stories are what shape many people's perception and understanding of disability, I think, before we even realise that's what it's doing. So I founded a website called Disabled Tales. I just created it and then put it out there. And the responses I got and still get for it is incredible, and it's so rewarding to see the vast ways people can interpret the same story, what bits people feel comforted by, what bits people want to challenge. Yeah, and I published way over 100 different pieces by various people now that all to this one arguably quite niche theme. But I think that's part of the joy of the universality of fairy tales, in a way that they speak to everyone in such different ways, and we can relate to them very personally, even though they're seen as quite generic.
Now, I was interested to read in your blog that the first time you had your writing listened to by others, you realised you were writing how you saw, and it wasn't entirely clear to the people listening.
Yeah, and that was a really surreal experience for me, because the blog you're talking about was one of the early times I really got feedback on my writing, because I was quite shy and nervous about sharing it for, like, most of my young adult and teenage and early 20s. So it was a really nerve-wracking thing for me to share this writing, but I hadn't really thought much about what I was writing other than, you know, just trying to create something good. But yeah, the feedback I got was about some of my descriptions being very detailed and yet vague at the same time. And I specifically remember describing a collection of people as just like a muddle of colour, and then a bit of that colour detaching from the mass. And that made me know that someone had left the group that the character was watching. And that would be how I would see, but I hadn't consciously written it like that. But that was the way I instinctively described it, because, I don't know, you just naturally reach for your own experiences. So for me, it was such an interesting accidental experiment. And now it's something I can be very much aware of if I'm writing a sighted character, that I need to know what they would see. And that's why reading books by sighted authors is how I've learned to do that, which is, again, quite an interesting concept. Yeah, it was a surprise, but not in a bad way. All their feedback was so positive, and yeah, I mean positive, but I mean useful. And it was just something I was completely oblivious to doing.
All this flashed through my panicked mind in a second, but then the shape moved again, and I realised that it wasn't a wolf at all, but a woman. She stood, dressed entirely in browns and greys, with hair of moon-bright silver and a face too far away for me to read her expression. I patted the tree branch and whispered my thanks to the tall oak. Then I took my first steps towards the woman. We rarely saw strangers in these parts, but I knew the polite greeting all the same. "How do?" I said. "How do?" Her voice was low and steady like the earth. It drew me towards her, the better to hear, and I drank in every word, as if this ordinary greeting was the beautiful poem I wanted to memorise.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
More from Beth in a moment, but for now,
brand new books available now from RNIB Libraries.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
We recently acquired The Lives of Lee Miller by Anthony Penrose.
Lee Miller, fashion model. Lee Miller, photographer. Lee Miller, war correspondent. Lee Miller, writer. Lee Miller, aficionado of classical music. Lee Miller, haute cuisine cook. Lee Miller, traveller. In all her different worlds, she moved with freedom. In all her roles, she was her own, bold self. A paradox of irascibility and effusive warmth, of powerful talent and hopeless incapability. Lee rode her own temperament through life as if she were clinging to the back of a runaway dragon. Sometimes the dragon triumphed and Lee was plunged into bleak, weeping despair. But mostly she took control and won a close-run victory against herself first and adversity second. Her successes always left an enduring impression. She loved to learn, create or take part, and then move on to something else. Some of her jags, as she called her current obsessions, would last only days. Others stretched for years.
Beautiful, bewitching, and an exceptionally good photographer, Lee Miller was one of life's adventurers. She became a Vogue cover girl in 1920s New York before embracing Paris, photography, and surrealism, and then dramatically changed her life yet again, reinventing herself as a war correspondent, notably covering the liberation of Dachau. These are but three of the many lives of Lee Miller. Penrose's tribute to his mother brings to life a uniquely talented woman and the turbulent times in which she lived.
Photography was her supreme jag, and she deserted it only when, after 30 years, she had exhausted all its abilities to provide excitement. Lee's spread of interests amounted to much more than the desultory pecking of a dilettante. Whatever she became involved in, her commitment was total, and the consequence to herself and others was of only minor consideration. Though Lee had an immense capacity to learn from other people, few can be seen to have had much influence on her. She herself changed little as she moved among the giant-sized characters that peopled her different worlds. The core of her character had been assembled, stamped and sealed for life at an early age under the supervision of a remarkable mechanical engineer, her father, Theodore Miller. Theodore Miller was descended from a Hessian soldier who settled in Lancaster, Pennsylvania after the Revolution. His father was a bricklayer from Richmond, Indiana, but Theodore started his working life as a machine operator making wooden wheels for roller skates. With tenacious application, he worked his way into progressively better jobs with the help of qualifications obtained through the International Correspondence School. In later years, when accused of being stubborn, he would dismissively say that stubbornness was just applied determination. This willfulness, an insatiable curiosity about all things mechanical and scientific, and a completely unabashed manner of asking questions were traits that his daughter inherited.
The Lives of Lee Miller by Anthony Penrose is read by Esther Wayne and Adam Grayson and runs for 7 hours and 14 minutes.
Recently released as a film, Star of Acre by Andrew Michael Hurley was given to us by John Murray from the Hachette Publishing Group.
Overnight, snow had fallen thickly again in Crofton Dale, and now in the morning the fells on the other side of the valley were pure white against the sky. Further down, where the sun had not yet reached, the wood by the beck was steeped in shadow and would stay cold all day. The freezing mist that was twined between the leafless beech and birch had already driven a hungry fox to seek food elsewhere. A line of deep paw prints came out of the gloom and into the pearly light that washed over the drifts on this side of the dale. Yet the animal seemed to have changed direction abruptly, startled into a hollow or a ditch by the folk out shooting nearby. Men from Micklebrow, probably, who'd walked over the moor to take advantage of the wide, empty canvas on which the grouse and pheasants were as bright as streaks of paint.
The worst thing possible has happened. Richard and Juliet Willoughby's son, Ewan, has died suddenly at the age of 5. Starve Acre, their house by the moors was to be full of life, but is now a haunted place. Juliet, convinced Ewan still lives there in some form, seeks the help of the Beacons, a seemingly benevolent group of occultists. Richard, to try and keep the boy out of his mind, has turned his attention to the field opposite the house, where he patiently digs the barren dirt in search of a legendary oak tree. It is a novel about the way in which grief splits the world in two, and how in searching for hope, we can so easily unearth horror.
The sound of shotguns and whistles doubled in air that was uncannily still and expectant after the blizzard. The storm had lasted for hours, and the extent of its fury was marked by icy cornices blown over the dry stone walls. They were wild, jagged crests, like those of a sea surge breaking on inadequate defences. So the winter went on, adding to itself day by day, making the houses in the dale seem even more remote from one another than usual. None of the farmers had been out yet with a plough, and on the road by Starve Acre, the snow cleared the evening before had frozen solid. All along the verges it was piled like crumbled pieces of cumulus.
Starve Acre by Andrew Michael Hurley is read by Richard Burnett and runs for 5 hours and 56 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks to Lynn Livingston from RNIB Library. Now back to Beth O'Brien.
Mother rarely mentioned my grandmother, but I knew that she'd left our village before I was born. So when this strange woman told me who she was, that she'd come back, I accepted it. To me, it felt perfectly natural that my grandmother should appear from nowhere, and I knew instinctively that she would understand me as well as trees know their leaves. She returned to the village with me that day. I burst in through the front door and gabbled out my explanation to Mother, pulling on Grandmother's sleeve as she hovered on the porch steps. My sister, Erona, hung back shyly, and my brother Lukey simply waved as though grandmothers appeared on our doorstep every day. Mother was silent. No smile, no tears, no welcome, no sign that she was happy to see Grandmother. She turned away, and I wondered if she was going to shout. But then she wordlessly laid another plate at the table. The thuds of the plate and cup sounded dismal in the quiet house. I didn't understand it.
I believe that when you heard the book was being recorded, you asked if you could go along to watch the recording.
I did. I invited myself and I felt so nervous doing it, but I sent a very tentative email being like, if possible, maybe please, if it's not too much trouble and I won't be in the way, I'd really love to tag along. But the audiobook was recorded at the RNIB and HarperCollins were more than happy for me to self-invite because I was just so interested to see behind the scenes, I suppose, and find out how it's all done, how it works, especially, yeah, as I already said, because I grew up listening to audiobooks and still now listen to audiobooks almost constantly.
Hello, I am Beth O'Brien and I'm here today at the RNIB with Niamh Longford, who has amazingly agreed to record the narration for the Wolf Siren audiobook. So I think this chat will probably go at the end of the audiobook. So if we talk about spoilers, don't listen past this point. But Niamh, thank you so much for agreeing to do this firstly and also letting me interrupt you with questions.
You are so welcome. Absolutely. Absolutely welcome. I'm very excited.
Oh, I'm so happy. I was so excited when I found out that you were going to be narrating. But from what I gather, you have done TV and you've done theatre, but you've not done an audiobook before.
I have not. This is first experience for me. So it's a lot of learning on the go, but with great source material, it can't go too wrong, can it?
Making me go red already. We've only just started.
It was incredible. It was so surreal to hear her reading the words I'd written. But we had a nice chat first before I even heard her read from the book. We recorded a Q&A, which is actually at the end of the audiobook. And it was incredible to sort of hear the acting that she'd done before and the differences in skill it took to read an audiobook, the preparation that goes into it, and then the setup of how the studio even works so that she can hear back what she's just read to carry on where she needs to pick up from. All very seamless and clever. And it meant a lot to me because Niamh is also visually impaired, so she really understood what I was trying to do with Red and the story I was trying to tell in Wolf Siren. So it was a really special day, and I loved getting that chance to talk to Niamh and then to hear her reading from the book. She was very self-deprecating, saying, oh, I make a lot of mistakes and things. But actually, when I was sat in the booth adjacent to hers and just listening, I just felt like I was listening to the audiobook, like already, like the live version. So it was a really special day, and I'm very grateful that I was able to tag along for that.
How are you finding it, recording it as an audiobook generally, but also compared to other acting you've done? Because I guess in this, you are all of the parts.
Yeah, it was quite freeing, actually, to be able to look at it and think, okay, I've been given the go-ahead to do essentially what I want with this within certain parameters. What do I want to do with it? And I thought a lot about voices and characteristics, who was maybe rougher sounding, who was softer, who was more authoritative. And I've gone more for that frame of characterization than accents, because you rightly so reminded me that they're all living in this small village with the same accents, essentially. And that actually makes it a lot easier to read if you're not jumping between a bunch of different accents. So it's been good, but it's made me realise there's a lot of words that I say very northernly. So I'm saying a lot of London lines, and then boom, just one random northern word.
Oh, so if you want to re-listen to the audiobook, try and spot Niamh's northern twang. I'm going to do that when I listen.
No, I would usually ask the writer if they fancied reading the audiobook, but I think you get a new appreciation for the skill when you went to record the author's note.
100%. Yeah, I don't know how Niamh did it. Honestly, she must have been exhausted. And when I first got there, I asked her, because I said I would definitely be needing a nap by now. For me, anything particularly longer than a tweet, I am using text-to-speech software to read because it's very visually tiring for me. But yeah, I was just mentioning about how Niamh would hear a playback of what she'd just read to then know where she'd got up to correctly, to then pick up the narration to continue the recording. But when I was having a go at recording the author's note, I couldn't find where was being played back fast enough to then pick it up, because I couldn't scan fast enough, I couldn't take in the words quickly enough. So in the end, the poor sound engineer, Jim, bless him, Jen just said, just read it and we'll edit it later, because I just didn't have the skills to track it fast enough and to work it out. But Niamh was doing that way better than I was. Also to say that she is actually northern and she read the whole book in a southern English accent. So that is a whole other skill as well, to read a whole book aloud in not your natural voice. So yeah, complete admiration for how she handled that, and bless her, how tired she must have been.
And as you said, there's a chat between you and Niamh at the end of the audio version of the book. This is a bit of a redundant question because I know how much you use audiobooks, but is it important though that it's in audio and it's accessible for all?
Yes, 100%. It was something, even when the book was going on submission to publishers, that me and my agent had already discussed, that it was something that was really important to me, because as exciting as it has been to see the book physically in bookshops and have people send pictures of them buying it and things, if it wasn't an audiobook and I was a member of the public, I wouldn't be going into a bookshop to buy the physical copy. I would be either buying the ebook or I would definitely be listening to the audiobook. So for me, to have that is really, really special and really important.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little description of it?
Yes, I can. And I absolutely love the cover. It was designed by Aisha El Rubio. And the cover is an autumnal woodland setting. And there's a girl in a red hooded cloak in the very centre. And she's standing very bold and tall. And around her, there are three huge wolves looking down at her. There is a title written in capitals in red writing that says Wolf Siren. And the letters are sort of interwoven between the trees. And below the title, There's a subheading that says, "Inside every good girl is a wolf." And for me, I just think it really captures the atmosphere and Red's bravery as she's standing in the midst of all of these huge wolves that are far bigger than her in this illustration.
So is Wolf Siren the sort of book and the sort of representation you wished you'd had when you were younger?
Yes, I think so, because what I love about her and writing her was that her disability is very much a part of her character, but like any other trait, the plot could theoretically be told with a sighted person. It doesn't really have a bearing on it other than this is how she experiences the world. And it's written from her perspective. And I found it really lovely even chatting to Niamh and her relating to some of the aspects of how she navigates the world and the amount of thought process that goes on behind what look like everyday activities. So I think for me that would have been empowering, or you just feel a bit more, I guess, feel like you're not the only one going through this sort of stuff. And I think recording the Q&A with Niamh for the end of the audiobook was also something that I'm really glad has happened, because I can imagine 10 or 11 year old me hearing that and being like, oh my goodness, there are adults out there who are visually impaired and these are the things they're doing, and how exciting that would have been to hear as a young visually impaired person who loved writing and audiobooking. So all of it for me is so rewarding, and really all of it's a dream come true, really.
So me and Niamh are both visually impaired. So when we came into the studio, I asked Niamh, on a scale of 1 to 10, how exhausted are you? Because if I was doing this, I would probably be needing a 3-hour nap right about now. Mm. So I don't actually know the extent of your visual impairment, Niamh, but do you want to talk a little bit about visually how you're finding it? Yeah, for you, what's it been like?
I won't lie, it is difficult. Because, as you'll understand, there's a lot of where you have to manage your time, of how much energy and effort you can expend. You can miscalculate it sometimes. And I think I can feel when I'm slipping a little bit, when guessing the words isn't getting as good as it should be, when I'm miscalculating one too many words. And we're only a few chapters in. So it's not an easy thing to do as a visually impaired person. But that doesn't mean that we can't do it or we shouldn't do it. We just have adaptations to make, or we need to know when to say, hold on, I was not giving you my full on that. Let's go again on that. Let's get it right.
Wolf Siren by Beth O'Brien is out now in print as an ebook and in audio as narrated by Niamh Longford. And Beth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And on the subject of fairy tales, I thought this was quite an appropriate archive interview recorded at the Wigtown Book Festival. Fairy tales are not just fairy tales. They are records of historical phenomena, telling us something about how Western civilization was formed. In The Fairy Tellers, award-winning travel writer Nick Jubber explores their secret history, the people who told them, the landscapes that forged them, and the cultures that formed them. Whilst we are familiar with some of the names entwined in the concept of a fairy tale, such as the Brothers Grimm or Hans Christian Andersen, there are tellers long buried, such as the Syrian storyteller Euhenna Diab, and the Wild Sisters of Cassel, without whom we would have never heard of Aladdin, his magic lamp, or the adventures of Hansel and Gretel. The Fairy Tellers, a journey into the secret history of fairy tales, is read by the author, Nicholas Jubber.
With parenthood, fairy tales spilled back into my life for the third time. There's only so many Zogs and lonely donkeys, not-so-scary snorklums and multiple Paw Patrols you can read aloud before you're hankering for the classics. My children's responses fascinated me. My animal-loving youngest identified with the wolf more than with Little Red Riding Hood, and there was a vulpine relish in his delivery of the line, "All the better to eat you with." My Star Wars eager eldest suggested Hansel and Gretel missed a trick by failing to go into the woods armed with lightsabers. In the games that followed, I found myself huffing and puffing over the bunk bed, which had turned into the brick house of the three little pigs, crouching troll-like underneath it, snarling at the trip-trapping of the billy goat's gruff and fee-fi-fo thumbing down the stairs to recover my golden harp from Jack. Occasionally I was pinned by the kind of crafty questions at which children are so preternaturally skilled. "Why are they called fairy tales?" I was asked one afternoon, a pair of button-shaped eyes gleaming over a stack of books, "when fairies don't even have tails." Another time a nose wrinkled over the kitchen table as the words floated over a tub of peanut butter. "Why are there so many witches in fairy tales, but never any wizards?" Gradually, other imaginative vistas lured the children away, and the traditional stories were left behind for dinosaurs and spaceships. But my old fascination had been relit, and I wasn't ready to give them up all over again. It was as if I'd been going back to the same party all through my life, but I'd never found out who had cooked all the delicious food, who'd made the decorations, who'd chosen the song list. It was time to find out who they were and give them thanks.
That was a clip of me, Nicholas Jubber, reading from my book, The Fairy Tellers. It is the story of the secret history behind fairy tales, and it's focusing on the lives of seven particular tellers. There's an Italian soldier of fortune who collected together Europe's first full collection of fairy tales. There's a Syrian draper from the souk of Aleppo who travelled all the way to Paris and told stories like Aladdin and Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. There is an aristocrat from France, a bankrupted aristocrat who wrote down Beauty and the Beast in 1740. There's an apothecary's daughter from Germany who told stories to the brothers Grimm, such as Rumpelstiltskin and the Six Swans and many others. There's a Russian folklorist who collected many stories about Baba Yaga, the witch in a hut on chicken legs, and many other magical tales, and also got involved in a plot to assassinate the Tsar. There's an Indian courtier who told tales to his queen to soothe her in a time of great trouble in medieval times. And finally, there's Hans Christian Andersen, the famous Danish fairy teller who told and invented many new stories such as the Snow Queen and the Little Mermaid and the Shadow and many others. And so it's about all these lives as a sort of cross-section of the history of fairy tales, hopefully telling the history of the form from medieval times right to the beginnings of the children's publishing industry in the 19th century.
Now, talking of children's publishing and Disney movies, do you think they've been really watered down? Because some of the tales are quite brutal.
Absolutely. When you go back into those original versions, and it's really one of the great things with studying something like the Brothers Grimm stories, for example, is you get lots of different editions and you can see
them actually becoming watered down even whilst they themselves were re-editing the stories. Their first earlier versions are much bloodier, much darker. Often the characters that would become stepmothers were in some of the original versions were the mothers. So, for example, the first version of Snow White, which was told by a young woman called Mary Hassenflug to the Brothers Grimm, in the first version, it's the mother who wants to kill Snow White and to eat her livers and her lungs and her heart so that she can absorb her beauty. And then that gets watered down. Slowly she becomes the stepmother, and then that sort of brutal cannibalistic element of it gets taken out of the story as well. And so then by the time you get to the 20th century and you have Disney trying to sort of repackage these stories for a mass audience, the stories are getting more and more diluted, and I think losing a lot of those very interesting and very, very, very exciting elements to them. But it, you know, that's part of a sort of a continuing capitalistic process, which Disney is part of. They're not the only sort of responsible party in that. Fairy tales stretch back at least 5,000 years, so scientists have declared. According to phylogenetic research, a biological process investigating the roots of language, the origins of stories like Beauty and the Beast and Jack and the Beanstalk can be traced back to the Bronze Age. It's a thrilling thought, linking us to listeners and storytellers across the millennia. But it overlooks something crucial, the stuff that brings the tales to life. It treats the tales as if they came fully formed, prioritising structural roots over the atmosphere and imagery embedded by individual storytellers.
Some of the tales you talked about, even the very first tellings of them, will be familiar. For instance, the tower with the long hair.
Well, there's Cinderella, for example, in Giambattista Basile's collection from the 17th century. There's the story of Cenerentola, and that would become then Cendrillon in French and then Cinderella in English. And it's the story of the skivvy, the girl who has to sort of skivvy for her stepsister and her stepmother, and they go to the ball, and then the fairy godmother turns her into, you know, gives her that makeover and the coach that can take her. And in the original version, by Giambattista Basile, the Neapolitan version, it
draws on aspects of the culture of the time, of Naples culture. So you have you have very noisy street scenes. There's not just one party, there's three. There's Italian food, ravioli and ricotta filled pastries at the feasts. And so it feels like you're taken into this sort of time, through the sort of time hole into this particular sort of moment in time. But because these stories have this sort of universal core, they could then be retold and reimagined in different cultures and different times.
How much of the research did you do through travel?
Well, I tried to travel to places connected with each of the storytellers. And so I traveled to Italy and across the Basilicata, the southern region of Italy, where I think a lot of the stories were collected by Gian Battista Basile, and met some actors who had been performing sort of some of those old folk tales. I traveled to Denmark and to Lapland in the wake of Hans Christian Andersen, and particularly the story of the Snow Queen, and got to meet some reindeer herders in Lapland and to talk to them about reindeer herding today. And I was trying to sort of connect that with the reindeer in the Snow Queen, and to see how some of those aspects of culture that Andersen brought into his stories, and which he himself researched very, very thoroughly at times, you know, how those have evolved and changed. And I also drew on some earlier travels to places like Kashmir. One of the storytellers in the book is Somadeva, who wrote a book called The Ocean of the Streams of Story, which was in Kashmir, and he was writing in a time of civil war to soothe his queen. And I travelled there a few years ago to the places where that court, where that medieval court was, and had experienced the travelling around the waterways of Srinagar. It's very, you know, you move around by water a lot, and that sort of is an aspect that you find in the landscapes of those stories, the lotus-filled lakes and so on. So I think it was really important to me to be able to connect each storyteller with some sense of having been there and having seen their world, so that you can sort of see the material world that they brought into their stories. Because along with that very universal core that a lot of these very popular stories have, there's also the world that these storytellers inhabited, which very much influenced the way that they told their tales.
Yeah, they would add local items to their tales, basically.
Absolutely, and you see that especially when you compare stories that have that universal appeal, but you can see how each time, each place and time that they're told, they draw on aspects of the culture. So, for example, there's a story from the Indian collection of the Golden City, where the crux of the story is the hero riding on the back of a talking bird, a Garuda in Hindu mythology, and then you find this, and he travels on this talking bird to a magical city of gold, and the story is retold in the 1001 Nights, but there the hero is travelling on a rock, which is a magical bird figure that we find in the tales of Sinbad and many Middle Eastern stories. And the story was even retold by Hans Christian Andersen, but he turned it into the wings of a swan, because that was part of the Nordic culture that he was drawing on. So each time you find these stories changing slightly and evolving, and I find that really exciting, the way that stories can adapt and evolve through geography, but also through time and through the centuries, but somehow retain that recognisable core, which reminds us of how bonded we are with people all around the world and all across time as well.
However vague their opening words may be, fairy tales are rarely located in the timeless zone of everywhere and everywhen. Once upon a time, or in French and German, there was once, there was, there wasn't in Arabic, there is in Sanskrit, is the deceptively non-committal doorway to a world that's often surprisingly particular. Spinning wheels and castles with jigsaw parapets, dark forests haunted by wolves and bears, heroes on horseback and princesses in veiled hennins leaning out of pointed towers. The classic Western fairy tale is time-locked inside a bubble of medieval Europe.
So this was the first audiobook you've narrated. How was that?
Oh, it was really fun. Yeah, really. It was. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a long process recording it. But I sometimes think it would be useful to read your book aloud properly when you can still make changes to it. But but it was a really, yeah, really interesting thing to do. And you know, a lot of these stories, I felt like it was appropriate as well, because a lot of these stories, they came out of oral culture. They're about people telling stories in social settings, or in you know, telling stories to be heard and listened to. So the idea that people will listen to these stories is really exciting. I think that's, you know, that's where these stories are at their absolute most sort of most exciting, I think.
Yes, yeah, stories existed long before print ever did.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the story, in many ways is the story of the transition from oral storytelling to print. And so with, as something I mentioned in the book, that each of the storytellers that I wrote about, they were each drawing in some ways on oral culture. Whether it was Giambattista Basile, the Italian storyteller who collected stories, he listened to people who would come when he was working as an administrator in various different courts and regions, and he would listen to the stories that people told him. Or the Brothers Grimm collected stories in their storytelling salon that they had in their home. Or Hans Christian Andersen, who would read his stories aloud to audiences and would tell stories, and enjoyed very much being the storyteller with people gathering around him to listen. So that is a really key part of it.
Some of them can be a bit squeamish. I'm thinking about a certain cockroach.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think those are some of the fun stories which have sort of, you're not going to find them in your anthologies or your collections for the nursery, but they are. I think they're some of the fun ones. And they're also, I think, some of the ones that are fun to tell to an adult audience. I think adults often respond to them. Children respond to some of those squeamish stories very much as well. So The Cockroach, the Mouse and the Cricket is one of my favourite stories by Giambattista Basile. But yeah, he was quite a bawdy writer in many ways. So his stories have a lot of strange and scatological material in them. Yeah.
When postmodernists construct their fairy tale pastiches, from Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods to Shrek to TV series like Once Upon a Time and Disenchanted, they paint their scenes from the same palette. But as we'll see, there are fairy tales all over the world, and they root themselves in their own settings.
The Fairy Tellers by Nicholas Jubber is available both in print and in audio, read by Nick himself.
Nicholas, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And finally, a return to Beth O'Brien for the books of her life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
There were lots of books in childhood that made me fall in love with reading, but specifically for audiobooks, the Harry Potter series narrated by Stephen Fry were my childhood, to the point that I remember getting half of the tapes for Christmas and my sister got the other half of the tapes of The Order of the Phoenix, because they were so many and it was so expensive that we got half a volume each and we would then share them. And for me, that was just pure magic. Those books and the world and Stephen Fry's narration were absolute favourites of mine.
Mr and Mrs Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal, thank you very much. They were the last people you'd expect to be involved in anything strange or mysterious, because they just didn't hold with such nonsense. Mr Dursley was the director of a firm called Grunnings, which made drills. He was a big, beefy man with hardly any neck, although he did have a very large moustache. Mrs. Dursley was thin and blonde and had nearly twice the usual amount of neck, which came in very useful, as she spent so much of her time craning over garden fences, spying on the neighbours. The Dursleys had a small son called Dudley, and in their opinion, there was no finer boy anywhere. The Dursleys had everything they wanted, but they also had a secret, and their greatest fear was that somebody would discover it. They didn't think they could bear it if anyone found out about the Potters. Mrs. Potter was Mrs. Dursley's sister, but they hadn't met for several years. In fact, Mrs. Dursley pretended she didn't have a sister, because her sister and her good-for-nothing husband were as un-Dursley-ish as it was possible to be. The Dursleys shuddered to think what the neighbours would say if the Potters arrived in the street. The Dursleys knew that the Potters had a small son too, but they had never seen him. This boy was another good reason for keeping the Potters away. They didn't want Dudley mixing with a child like that. When Mr. and Mrs. Dursley woke up on the dull, grey Tuesday our story starts, there was nothing about the cloudy sky outside to suggest that strange and mysterious things would soon be happening all over the country. Mr. Dursley hummed as he picked out his most boring tie for work, and Mrs. Dursley gossiped away happily as she wrestled a screaming Dudley into his high chair. None of them noticed a large, tawny owl flutter past the window. That's Stephen Fry narrating from Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, available, as are all of the Harry Potter books, from the RNIB library in both audio and braille. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yeah, well, I could just say the Harry Potters again, but I would say my comfort read for sure would be Anne of Green Gables. I just love the way she views the world. Like, it's such a joyous book, even though her life is actually very tragic. But her enthusiasm and just the comedy of it, the sort of innocence of her worldview and the way Avonlea adapt to her and she changes people's minds about what is right and wrong. I just find it so wholesome and also hilarious.
Marilla came briskly forward as Matthew opened the door. But when her eyes fell on the odd little figure in the stiff, ugly dress, with the long braids of red hair and the eager, luminous eyes, she stopped short in amazement. "Matthew Cuthbert? Who is that?" she ejaculated. "Where is the boy?"
"There wasn't any boy," said Matthew wretchedly. "There was only her."
He nodded at the child, remembering that he had never even asked her name. "No boy, but there must have been a boy," insisted Marilla. "We sent word to Mrs. Spencer to bring a boy."
"Well, she didn't. She brought her. I asked the station manager, and I had to bring her home. She couldn't be left there, no matter where the mistake had come in."
"Well, this is a pretty piece of business," ejaculated Marilla. During this dialogue, the child had remained silent, her eyes roving from one to the other, all the animation fading out of her face. Suddenly, she seemed to grasp the full meaning of what had been said. Dropping her precious carpet bag, she sprang forward a step and clasped her hands. "You don't want me?" she cried. "You don't want me because I'm not a boy? I might have expected it. Nobody ever did want me. I might have known it was all too beautiful to last. I might have known nobody really did want me. Oh, what shall I do? I'm going to burst into tears." Burst into tears she did, sitting down on a chair by the table, flinging her arms out upon it and burying her face in them. She proceeded to cry stormily. Marilla and Matthew looked at each other deprecatingly across the stove. Neither of them knew what to say or do. Finally, Marilla stepped lamely into the breach. "Well, there's no need to cry so about it."
"Yes, there is need."
The child raised her head quickly, revealing a tear-stained face and trembling lips.
"You would cry, too, if you were an orphan and had come to a place you thought was going to be home and found that they didn't want you because you weren't a boy. Oh, this is the most tragical thing that ever happened to me."
Something like a reluctant smile, rather rusty from long disuse, mellowed Marilla's grim expression.
"Well, don't cry any more. We're not going to turn you out of doors tonight. You'll have to stay here until we investigate this affair. What's your name?"
The child hesitated for a moment.
"Will you please call me Cordelia?"
she said eagerly.
"Call you Cordelia? Is that your name?"
"No, it's not exactly my name. But I would love to be called Cordelia. It's such a perfectly elegant name."
That's Sarah Mennell reading from Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery. The whole Green Gables and Avonlea books are available from RNIB Library. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
Well, the last book, well, I listened to it, literally just came out. It is Sunrise on the Reaping, which is the Hunger Games prequel. I read the Hunger Games series as a teen, and I love them. And I love that Suzanne Collins has just sort of been releasing pre-story novels here and there. So I'd pre-ordered it. I was ready on the day it was released. I checked my Audible to check it had appeared. I just love the world. I just And it's so fun to read the prequels and spot the characters that appear in the later series. So yeah, I was very excited for that to come out.
Happy birthday, Haymitch.
The upside of being born on Reaping Day is that you can sleep late on your birthday. It's pretty much downhill from there. A day off school hardly compensates for the terror of the name drawing. Even if you survive that, nobody feels like having cake after watching two kids being hauled off to the Capitol for slaughter. I roll over and pull the sheet over my head.
Happy birthday!
My 10-year-old brother Sid gives my shoulder a shake.
You said be your rooster. You said you wanted to get to the woods at daylight.
It's true. I'm hoping to finish my work before the ceremony, so I can devote the afternoon to the two things I love best, wasting time and being with my girl, Lenore Dove. My mom makes indulging in either of these a challenge, since she regularly announces that no job is too hard or dirty or tricky for me, and even the poorest people can scrape up a few pennies to dump their misery on somebody else. But given the dual occasions of the day, I think she'll allow for a bit of freedom, as long as my work is done. It's the game makers who might ruin my plans.
Hey, Mitch, wails Sid. The sun's coming up.
All right, I'm up too. I roll straight off the mattress onto the floor and pull on a pair of shorts made from a government-issued flour sack. The words, courtesy of the Capitol, end up stamped across my butt. My ma wastes nothing.
Sunrise on the Reaping, a Hunger Games novel by Suzanne Collins, is available in audio commercially as read by Jefferson White. And once again, Beth O'Brien, author of Wolf Siren, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.